right, we're going to begin. This is going to be a dialectic session at times. So what do you want to know about me?
Where are you from?
I grew up in South Bend, Indiana. I lived in Chicago for 20 years, and now I live in Nashville, Tennessee. Cool. Banjo? Mm-hmm. Yeah. 1,462 guitar pickers in Nashville. There's actually a lot more than that. Come on in. You're welcome. We're going to spend time talking about whether we can be Christian in church. That seemed like a ridiculous question. No, it's not. It's not. This morning I was sitting out on the ark after breakfast, and a couple of days I've been sitting on the porch and watching hummingbirds at the hummingbird feeder. They attack each other, and there were some crumbs on a bench on the ark this morning, and there were about five of those brown squirrels out there, and they were just really nasty to one another, too. So, you know, even the squirrels and the hummingbirds seem to have problems living in community. Really, what we're going to talk about today is what is Christian community? There's one chair here, too. If somebody else comes in, I'll try to put it that way. What is Christian community? And I'm just going to ask you some questions about that to begin with. There's one chair up here. And grab another one. You know, what's the shape of Christian community? Is Christian community a circle? Is it a triangle? Does it take on a kind of a Trinitarian shape? Is it a rectangle? Does it take on the shape of our sanctuaries? What is the shape of Christian community? What constitutes Christian community? Is it a center or is it boundaries, the edge? Are those edges rigid walls or are they permeable, like the gate to the vegetable garden that the rabbits seem to be going through? What holds Christian community together? Is it a history? Is it our investment or our buy-in or our length of tenure? Is it agreement, you know, like-mindedness? Is it relationships, practices, things we do together? A common culture. What holds Christian communities together? How is Christian community different from the other communities in which we live? Schools, governments, towns, clubs we belong to, workplaces, all these are communities. What makes Christian community different from those, if it is? What are the limits to Christian community? Are there limits to Christian community? And if there are, what are they? And why do we set them? On what grounds do we set limits to Christian community? So we have one chair right here still, too, if you want to sit on the chair. Are there particular times and places at which we have special limits in Christian community? Special occasions such as worship. You know, there was a wedding up on the ark about 35, 45 minutes ago. This is not a case about people raising their hands in worship. This is not a case about speaking in tongues. This is not even a case about snake handling. You know about snake handling?
Yes.
Yeah, they do that in my part of the country. Wouldn't happen at my church. None of those things would happen at my church. So clearly some things have happened that set limits. This is not a case about those things, but if I can find where I buried my Bible, let's listen to a couple passages from the Gospel of Matthew that might inform things that we would want to say about limits. This is from Matthew 18, chapter 10. See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that in heaven the angels always behold the face of my Father who is in heaven. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And when he finds it, Truly I say to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that went astray. So it is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. There's one way. Now we're going to think about Matthew chapter 13, verses 47 through 48. Instead of sheep, it's fish this time. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a net which was thrown into the sea and gathered fish of every... When it was full, they drew it ashore and sat down and sorted the good into vessels, but threw away the bad. And so it will be at the close of the age. The angels will come out and separate the evil from the righteous, throw them into the furnace of fire. There they will weep and gnash their teeth. I like that. Can you gnash your teeth? Let's do it together in unison. Yeah, that's great. All right. Okay, can we be Christian in church? You can't make this up, part one. This was an email I got from a friend of mine who headed a mission station in Africa. He wrote, "Dear Mark, I have an ethical dilemma and I seek your wise words of wisdom." Anybody who starts a letter to me like that gets my response. "The mission is struggling financially. If we do not get money, we may have to close programs early next year. We have already retrenched staff and gone on half-time with others. A good friend of mine talked to a fundraiser. The fundraiser emailed me, and then I called her. She wants very much to make a proposal to the National Lottery. I have always been opposed to taking lotto money. Our management team, not the board, has also agreed with this. I know all the woman is saying is rational, that we will not stop poor people from gambling, but this is a chance to use the money for good. I am still very hesitant, but felt it was worth the effort to call board members and see what they think and what their denominational stands are. If we do this, do it in the next 2 weeks or wait until 2005. Would like to take time to write more, but must rush on. We are having a mild winter, but the nights have been rather biting. Peace, Larry." Okay, there's a kind of a funny dilemma we have to deal with in church. You can't make this up, part two. This was a former student of mine who wrote this. One weekend when I was on call for hospital visits, I received a call that informed me that the niece of our custodian had been struck by a car, was in the emergency room at the local hospital. Another minister and I arrived, spent some time talking and praying, and then stood by them as their daughter was taken off life support. Following this, I spoke with the custodian and his brother, the father of the little girl, who informed me that they would like to have the funeral at the church where I worked, and that they would like for the minister of the church where they attended to officiate. The next morning, as details became clearer, I discovered that the church they attended was a local enclave of fundamentalism, and that the minister who would officiate was the very same person who had organized and keynoted at a local I Love America rally, where he told gays, lesbians, Muslims, non-Christian immigrants, liberals, and a number of other groups to find another country and stop polluting ours. I brought the issue to our staff, all of whom were puzzled as to what the best solution to this situation might be. The senior minister decided to call the chair of the elders, a trusted mentor and retired minister, for advice. However, before he could make the call, the director of the funeral home called, informing us that the minister from the Fundamentalist Church had offered his building for the funeral and the family had accepted. Can't make this up. These things happen in our communities of faith all the time, and they test our ability to live faithfully with one another. We're going to talk about another case today, about a situation in a church at worship, and I'm going to read you some information about this case, and then we're going to spend some time dividing up into small groups of five or six or so. We tried to cluster the chairs a little bit so that some of that grouping would not be too terribly difficult. Because I'm going to ask you to think about what you would do in these small groups and then be able to share that with the rest of us. And then I'll tell you how this particular church dealt with this question in their life. And then you can again be in small groups and talk about what you think of their response. Okay? That's how we'll spend our hour today. What then shall we do? Strange things happen. I want to make this one more point here. We do often struggle, fall short, and oftentimes we work harder at avoiding dealing with things than we do at being faithful about them. I think we can do better, and I think when we do, it helps. helps our communities be more faithful throughout their life. That's what I mean by integrity. And it sends a message about us that is not hypocritical. I mean, the church has a really lousy reputation in American culture right now as being judgmental, harsh, hypocritical, moralistic. A lot of people are avoiding church because of this. If we live together faithfully, I think we can be more of a transparent witness about our life together. And I also think it helps individuals in community to learn how to make more faithful choices in their own lives, and it helps us make more choices that are faithful about our larger culture, whether they be political, moral, ethical, whatever. So I think it's important for the church to have integrity as much as it can, and I also realize that it's a fallen human institution, but this is where I'm going. Okay, let's see. This is a congregation that's small, averages about 70, slightly aging, mostly Anglo, middle class, retirees, and people who are working, mix of blue collar, white collar people. Congregation had been larger but had experienced decline for about 35 years. Why was that loud? Okay. Well, the community where this church is located is in a large metropolitan area. It's a suburban ring of a larger city, extremely poor suburb on one border, extremely affluent suburb on the other border. The place where it was located had suffered loss of industrial base, housing base. It was highly segregated. The political structures were extremely corrupt. The congregation thought about moving to a more hospitable location for it, but decided that God was calling for them to stay and minister in that place. And as part of their ministry, that congregation had started a shelter for homeless people that it called PADS, and it housed about 55 or 60 people a night in the church building. Lots of people in the church had been active in many ministries in that community. At one time, the congregation measured about 3/4 of its active membership who were directly involved in some hands-on ministry of service to and with the poor in that church. So these were committed, faithful, socially conscious, activist Christians in this community. One day during the week, I'm going to read now what the minister wrote about this event, okay? Keith B., a young black man, came to the church for help with clothes and cab fare to a job interview in another town. And the minister helped him out with some cab fare, and he rummaged through a clothes bin that the church kept in its entry area and picked out some better clothes to wear to this job interview. He obviously didn't get the job because shortly after that he became a guest at the church's homeless shelter, and he became a little bit of a problem in the homeless shelter program. He slept late despite repeated wake-up calls. Guests were expected to get up about an hour before they were required to leave. He often waited until right before the departure time, and then would begin to use the bathroom and would often be found stark naked in the bathroom in the middle of a sponge bath. And he hung around while people were trying to clean up and straighten up. Volunteers were the folks who staffed the shelter. And he would eat breakfast after everybody else was gone and would ask for extra food. And the volunteers began to get a little irritated with him because he was in the way of their morning cleanup. And they had been there for 3 or 4 hours already from 3 in the morning until 7:30 or 8 when they were done. Keith returned to the church a number of times for money, food, or help. Another time he helped himself to more clothes. Another time he asked the church's secretary to type something for him, and since she was the only one in the building at that time when he got in, she felt a little bit intimidated and ended up using about an hour of her time, as she described later, typing gibberish. He received food from the homeless shelter supplies in the church kitchen at least one time, and upon subsequent visits, he was persistent about asking for these kinds of help again. Early one morning, says the pastor, as I was in my office prior to the secretary's arrival, I heard the church door open. At that time, we were keeping the door unlocked. I'm waiting for the laughter there.
Yeah.
Since the hinges squeaked loudly upon opening, I was usually aware when someone came in. A church member who came in would invariably stick their head into my office and announce their presence. This time, however, no one stuck their head in. After I finished on the phone, I went down the hall to the secretary's office and found Keith there, sitting at her desk, acting as if he was preparing to use the church computer. And the pastor says, I asked him to leave. Now we're going to talk about the events of a Sunday in April. One Sunday, he attended adult education and worship. Since he had said he was hungry during adult education, people in the Sunday school class got him some milk and orange juice from the refrigerator in the church kitchen. During worship, he sat next to an older lady in church. She later said that she was disturbed because he sat very close to her and would not move away even when she asked him to. She also reported that he smelled as if he needed a bath. After worship, Keith went around to several worshipers and asked them for money. At least one person gave him some. Following worship, Keith went downstairs to the church kitchen, where again on his own he drank more milk from the church refrigerator. The pastor writes, I noticed this, was concerned, and asked a man in the church to make sure that he left the building before it was closed for the day, and he did so. In addition, that Sunday, another person who was drunk came to worship and sat in a rear pew. He slept off his drunk during the service, but he was noticeable, and some people commented on how dirty and unclean he was. Early the next Sunday morning, at an elders' meeting prior to Sunday school and worship, one of the elders brought up the issue of Keith's panhandling, which had been unknown to me until then. Other details of his behavior the previous Sunday emerged at the meeting. Unfortunately, this discussion began toward the end of the meeting and time was running short. Still, the elders decided together to authorize an announcement by the minister if Keith was present that day. The announcement would say that we had a problem last Sunday with panhandling. We believe such behavior was not appropriate in the church, and the elders urged worshipers not to encourage it by giving money to people who might ask them. We felt such an announcement was not directed at a person, but at a behavior of which we did not approve. We also felt that the announcement was directed to our worshipers, to those whom we could effectively influence, rather than those who might be panhandling. I was in agreement with the announcement, even though it made me a little uncomfortable. Okay? The minister continues. Of course, Keith was present that morning, sitting in the front row. I felt a little awkward, but I made the announcement we had agreed upon. After worship, Keith was perturbed and said to me, I need money, man. I related that asking people for money at church was not appropriate. Keith left the sanctuary, went down to the kitchen. An older lady was in the kitchen alone preparing snacks for coffee hour. She asked Keith not to get into the refrigerator. However, he ignored her and helped himself to more milk. She reported later feeling rather threatened by his presence and lack of acquiescence to her request. Her daughter phoned me the following week with this part of the story. Since we had an elders' meeting scheduled, she requested that we discuss the problem of difficult worship visitors, including the unkempt drunk, with the meeting. Okay? Got it?
Yep.
Understand what's going on? Can you divide yourself into groups of five or six? I think we ought to be able to try to do that. Can you try to turn your chairs around so you can talk to one another? Maybe six or seven, it's okay with me. The question, friends, is that which those who hear Peter preach after Pentecost say to Peter, what then shall we do? They are convicted. What then shall we do? Okay, I need to call everybody back to time. You don't have to turn your chairs. Stay where you are. You're fine where you are.
Oh, we have the sheep on this side, the goats on the other side. All right. Call on time. I know this can be a
All right, I'm torn between telling you what this church did and hearing what you think they should have done. So I don't know exactly how to go. I'd like to hear a few things from you. So let me start with this group. What do you think they should have done?
Put Don Benson on it.
By that,
I mean, put Don Benson on it. You know, there are some people that are just so good at interacting and building relationships and getting people to listen. And then we said, have a team ministry, you know, of people who are particularly good at that.
Okay.
Maybe have training in that.
Okay.
For welcoming visitors that are maybe still sleeping at, you know.
Right. Okay. How about a group back here? Some of your thoughts. I mean, I'm not skipping over.
Any thoughts here?
We thought there should be more than one person of authority in the church who would sit down with Keith and tell him the boundaries.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. How about that corner?
Well, first we were just generally critiquing that nobody, it seemed like nobody had really sat down with him ever just to like hear his story and learn about him and build any kind of relationship. And this announcement was just a very, very passive aggressive and a shaming one, too. And so I guess we were kind of wishing that had already happened, but maybe that could still happen. Someone could sit down with him and also take him seriously as a person who's coming to worship and maybe say, you know, have a faith conversation about what is going on.
Good boundaries can provide safety and allow some of those relationships like they're talking about to develop.
One-on-one support person similar to the first group, we have Stephen ministers who are trained, and you could assign a Stephen minister, the right person, to this fellow and say, we're teaming up here to help you, and it could work. It could be helpful.
Okay. I heard the slight emphasis inflection on could.
Yeah.
Okay, how about this group?
Hear his story. Help him tell his story. And this isn't, I just thought of this, so it's not
okay.
Necessarily good.
Okay.
But he might even be able to tell his story to the community, because if we hear someone's story, that could be an opening to minister to them.
Okay.
But someone else can report with the group.
We're going to move on. We're going to go here.
We also talked about one-on-one conversation and boundary setting. And then in addition, we talked about this sort of cultural clash that's going on between the congregation and the homeless shelter, and that this one individual is just representative of a whole cultural clash. So if this is a ministry to which the congregation is truly committed, then they're going to need to be open to some changes. So they really need to sit down and decide, is this something we want to do? And if so, what kinds of, in addition to boundaries, what kinds of changes and accommodations do we need to make as a community?
Because even if you deal with Keith, there's going to be another, if you're
yeah.
truly opening your doors to people at this point of life, then it's going to be a culture change in the church.
Yeah,
we'll have to be ready for that.
Okay, this is really helpful stuff. Again, feel free to stay where you are. I'm sorry if you're going to have to twist your neck. If you want to turn your chair, go ahead. Here's what the church did. Okay, At their, I misread before, at their board meeting, again, the minister's reporting, we talked things over. Although we all felt some reluctance to act decisively, nonetheless, we passed the following policy statement. Quote, panhandling and begging for food are not appropriate behaviors in church on Sunday morning. While we cannot control the behavior of guests, and while all people are welcome in worship and at the Lord's table, unless they make themselves unwelcome by their behavior, nevertheless, we urge our regular attenders not to encourage begging at Sunday worship by giving food or money in response. End quote. Discussion included comments about how worshipers, particularly older women, felt especially vulnerable on Sunday morning to inappropriate badgering. Discussion also included comments about the drunk who slept it off during worship and how this was not necessarily pleasant, but also not worthy of any similar response. Finally, discussion included comments, if you'll like this, about referring all such cases to the pastor. It was agreed that normally consulting with the pastor is appropriate, but that the pastor would not be very available on Sunday morning. Lay people should not, therefore, expect the pastor to, quote, take care of it, end quote, for them. It was further decided that Keith would no longer be welcome at worship. He had shown a consistent pattern of pushing the limits in his behavior at pads, at the church, in earlier requests for help during the week and on Sunday mornings. We were concerned that he would continue to push the limits with his actions in ways that would be hard to anticipate and deal with effectively. We were also very aware of how vulnerable the entire church is during worship. Small children in the nursery or in the Sunday morning club, our program for children who leave worship partway through, even with supervision, might be vulnerable to a determined and aggressive male. The next Sunday, therefore, when Keith showed up for worship again, he was asked to leave. I had wondered about the situation, how it would be handled. As it turns out, it was Youth Sunday, and I was sitting in the congregation. As soon as I saw Keith enter the sanctuary, I went to him and explained that he was no longer welcome in the church. I attempted to explain that his begging had been disruptive and inappropriate, as had his raiding of the refrigerator. Two other men helped me escort him to the door. He left, accusing us of being racists. End of episode. Okay, now you can get back to your group and talk about what you think of that church response. Okay? I'm going to give you just 5 minutes. What do you think?
That's perfect. All the other ends.
All right, I need to bring your discussion to close momentarily. Just a quick call back to the center. Ah, the Lord made their hearts hard and their necks stiff.
Wow, does anybody know, somebody afterwards, if you know the answer to this, if you went to the Bible study about manna and you saw the great picture from the altar art that showed Moses with the manna raining down, and he had these kind of cool things, they look sort of like Viking helmet horns. Anybody who knows what they really are, tell me after class.
Moses was Norwegian.
I knew it would be something like that. And here I thought he was Scottish all the time. Okay. A quick run around the room. We have about 15 minutes. I declare that clock is 2 minutes fast. So, what do you think of what this church did? Thumbs up or thumbs down? Let's just do that all across the room. If thumbs up on what the church did, anybody who likes it? Thumbs down. Woo! Okay. So are we going to cast that church into outer darkness? Excommunicate them.
Yeah, we're going to put them in a 12-step program.
Okay, this is really interesting here, and what I want to do is in some ways shift gears a little bit from what we should do or what we think of what they do to the next level up of how do we come to these kinds of choices or decisions when we're faced with difficult things like this, because we do get faced with them all the time. And this part I'm going to repeat in the next two sessions, and we're going to do a case tomorrow about a family who comes to a church and the church tries to help them. And then on Friday we're going to do a case, I guess it's at 6:15, tomorrow's is at 4, but on a sexual predator within a congregation. I think this next piece, you know, is something more general. That's my attempt to try to help you think about how you can think about these things in community, okay? And excuse the lousy humor. You know what a capon is? You know, okay. Oh, lots of people know what a capon is. All right. Well. All right.
Lunch for the Shakespeare class.
I'm just, you know, this is a great preaching tradition to come up with silly opening syllables, and so I tried to figure out how that would work. These are five things that I think you want to take into account when you're trying to consider how to deal with and think about and make faithful choices in the face of these kind of tough situations. Context. What's happening? What's going on here? And, you know, that might have to take a whole bunch of things into account. In this particular case, context included the congregation, its geography, its makeup, the demographics, its community, how the community had changed over time, its own efforts to be hospitable to those in need and to serve them, and so forth. So, context. All these kinds of things that one sociologist calls a thick description. All right? Yeah.
I think another context is the size of the congregation.
Yeah? Yeah, and would you say why?
Well, because some of the things that we came up with here would require a lot of people being involved, a lot of people with either special desires or special skills. And if you're a large congregation, you may have that. If you're a small congregation, you either have to beg, buy, borrow, or steal it, or, you know, so I think there's a difference there.
Yeah. So these are the kinds of really important context considerations that we need to take into account. When these things are happening to us, we're living them, and we often don't pull them up to conscious awareness, but I mean, it's like fish in water. The context of our life together is really important in how we can respond. A, aim. What's our purpose? And I think we share a great deal of commonality in all Christian traditions about our purpose as the church, the community of the faithful. But I also think that every community has its own particularities. So a particular people in a particular tradition, particular place, particular time, all those things shape our aim. Whether our aim is survival as in some way a sanctuary, as a sign of God's presence, besieged presence in a difficult world, or whether our aim is mission. You know, we have a full commitment to openness and not permeable permeable boundaries, not rigid boundaries. Those things, those matters of aim, calling. I don't like the mission statement language, but I know it's used pretty commonly. I don't like it because it's usually so brief as to be meaningless. So what are the ways in which we understand our aim, our calling, is really what I prefer to talk about in church now. Okay? A third thing, process. What's a fair and loving way to decide? In the American church, votes are the norm. And votes are, I tell people avoid votes at any possible time because they create winners and losers. So if the aim of Christian community is to build community. You don't want to divide it in, you know, ways like that. So are there ways we can seek? And there are many processes for building consensus or discerning or things like that that we can use. We don't have to expect unanimity, but what's a fair and loving way? And again, the loving and fair comes right out of our aim and purpose as being a Christian community. Then I have oughts and nays. What must we consider and do? And nays, what must we avoid? I have a list of six things that we ought to consider and do, and they're not going to be surprises to any of you. And I didn't put together a list of nays, but I just gave you one. Voting is oftentimes not a great way to do it. But oughts. Here's six specifics. Scripture. Does the scripture speak to us in these tough situations? Christians ought to be turning to our central revelation in some way. That doesn't have to be proof texting, but it could be a story. It could be, you know, the story of the Good Samaritan could have spoken to this particular situation, as could many others. And I shared the lost sheep. I also shared culling the great catch of fish. Okay? Both of those stories speak to this situation. Themes, parables, scriptural events, people, commands.
Did I miss this? Was there any reference to scripture in the case study itself?
Don't think so. I don't think it was reported in the case study. But certainly we want to think about that, and not in tiny ways, but in large and expansive ways. The second thing, you know, the whole discipline of ethics tries to help us understand what shall we do? What is the good life? What is righteousness? And what is worthy for us to do? Three main ways of thinking about ethics are, you know, rules or obligations, consequences or outcomes, and virtues or our character. So, would we want to be able to think through those things and see if they might help inform us? Spiritual insights. What is God telling the community of the faithful through prayer or discernment or fasting or the other spiritual disciplines, either to us as individuals or to the entire community? Theological insights. When I think about theology, you know, are we thinking well and clearly? Sometimes we don't do that. Are we thinking about images of God, church, ministry, and how they work in our community? Where is the Holy Spirit? Where is the face of Jesus? You know, about seeing the face of Jesus in the other. What wisdom might help us? A fifth thing, human wisdom. Psychology and sociology. How does personality play a part? How do our roles that we take within a community impact us? And what is the impact of the emotional or the non-rational? So often, churches, I was talking to somebody last week here who was part of a planning process to make their church more green, and they got a long way down the road on that, made a proposal to the board of the church, and I think it was about to be voted on. And some people in the church subverted that process, some large donors subverted that process, and it didn't happen, didn't come through. The people who had worked really hard on this, the ones I had spoken to last week, were very frustrated and upset and angry about that. They had anticipated a rational process. And communities, well, don't we always? Aren't you expecting that in 5 minutes you're going to go to lunch? Well, but we're not rational. It's not that we're irrational. It's just that we're emotional beings, we're spiritual beings, we're non-rational, and our organizations, particularly churches, reflect that. It's not bad, but you got to take it into account, and sometimes it gets in the way. So for this particular case, there was a lot of anxiety among people who felt vulnerable to a person who apparently would not respect limits and boundaries. And their need to feel safe in the sanctuary is not necessarily wrong. And how could that safety be assured is, you know, a tricky thing. Emotional, non-rational, personality, roles, those kinds of things. Yeah, so a lot of you spoke about in a relational way. In fact, that was when you first fed back as small groups. Relationality and human wisdom from psychology or sociology was really where you were operating from primarily. That was a first response. How can we care? And we can do that by listening, by hearing his story, by having a number of people work with him and so forth. See how I'm going with that? Okay. A sixth piece. And this is one that theologians usually forget. But when you're in church, you're inevitably in relationship and in community. And so we have to think not individually, which is the American norm, but we have to think about how will our choice or our decision build up, edify the body of Christ. This is kind of Paul's primary criterion for Christian life together. Does it build up the body of Christ? You can speak in tongues, but does it edify? It doesn't edify unless you have someone to interpret. You understand what I'm talking about? Okay. Those are six things that I'm just offering to you as things to keep in mind when you have to face these kinds of challenges. And if you want to have fun talking about another one tomorrow, come on down. That's all I've got. Any questions or feedback or response? Or should we end a minute early and release you? All right, thank you very much. I'm glad to hear you.